Chapter 11. The Evidence of Miss Debenham. When Mary Debenham entered the dining car, she confirmed Poirot's previous estimate of her. Very neatly dressed in a little black suit with a French grey shirt, the smooth waves of her dark head were neat and unruffled. Her manner was as calm and unruffled as her hair. She sat down opposite Poirot and Monsieur Bouc and looked at them inquiringly.
"Your name is Mary Hermione Debenham, and you are 26 years of age," began Poirot.
"Yes."
"English?"
"Yes."
"Will you be so kind, mademoiselle, as to write down your permanent address on this piece of paper?"
She complied. Her writing was clear and legible.
"And now, mademoiselle, what have you to tell us of the affair last night?"
"I'm afraid I have nothing to tell you. I went to bed and slept."
"Does it distress you very much, mademoiselle, that a crime has been committed on this train?"
The question was clearly unexpected. Her grey eyes widened a little.
"I don't quite understand you." "It was a perfectly simple question that I ask you, mademoiselle. I will repeat it. Are you very much distressed that a crime should have been committed on this train?"
"I have not really thought about it from that point of view. No, I cannot say that I am at all distressed."
"A crime, it is all in the day's work to you, eh?"
"It is naturally an unpleasant thing to have happened," said Mary Debenham quietly.
"You are very Anglo-Saxon, mademoiselle. Vous n'éprouvez pas d'émotion."
She smiled a little. "I'm afraid I cannot have hysterics to prove my sensibility. After all, people die every day."
"They die, yes, but murder is a little more rare."
"Oh, certainly."
"You were not acquainted with the dead man?"
"I saw him for the first time when lunching here yesterday."
"And how did he strike you?"
"I hardly noticed him."
"He did not strike you as an evil personality?"
She shrugged her shoulders slightly. "Really, I cannot say I thought about it."
Poirot looked at her keenly. "You are, I think, a little bit contemptuous of the way I prosecute my inquiries," he said with a twinkle. "Not so, you think, would an English inquiry be conducted there. Everything would be cut and dried. It would be all kept to the facts. A well-ordered business. But I, mademoiselle, have my little originalities. I look first at my witness. I sum up his or her character, and I frame my questions accordingly. Just a little minute ago, I am asking questions of a gentleman who wants to tell me all his ideas on every subject. Well, him I keep strictly to the point. I want him to answer yes or no, this or that, and then you come. I see at once that you will be orderly and methodical. You will confine yourself to the matter in hand. Your answers will be brief and to the point, and because, mademoiselle, human nature is perverse, I ask of you quite different questions. I ask what you feel, what you thought. It does not please you, this method?"
"If you will forgive my saying so, it seems somewhat of a waste of time. Whether or not I liked Mr. Ratchett's face does not seem likely to be helpful in finding out who killed him."
"Do you know who the man Ratchett really was, mademoiselle?"
She nodded. "Mrs. Hubbard has been telling everyone."
"And what do you think of the Armstrong affair?"
"It was quite abominable," said the girl crisply. Poirot looked at her thoughtfully.
"You are travelling from Baghdad, I believe, Miss Debenham?"
"Yes."
"To London?"
"Yes."
"What have you been doing in Baghdad?"
"I have been acting as governess to two children."
"Are you returning to your post after your holiday?"
"I am not sure."
"Why is that?"
"Baghdad is rather out of things. I think I should prefer a post in London if I can hear of a suitable one."
"I see. I thought perhaps you might be going to be married."
Miss Debenham did not reply. She raised her eyes and looked Poirot full in the face. The glance said plainly, "You are impertinent."
"What is your opinion of the lady who shares your compartment, Miss Olson?"
"She seems a pleasant, simple creature."
"What colour is her dressing gown?"
Mary Debenham stared. "A kind of brownish colour, natural wool."
"Ah, I may mention without indiscretion, I hope, that I noticed the colour of your dressing gown on the way from Aleppo to Stamboul. A pale mauve, I believe.
Yes, that is right.
Have you any other dressing gown, mademoiselle? A scarlet dressing gown, for example?
No, that is not mine.
Poirot leaned forward. He was like a cat pouncing on a mouse.
Whose, then?
The girl drew back a little startled.
I don't know. What do you mean? You do not say, no, I have no such thing. You say, that is not mine, meaning that such a thing does belong to someone else?
She nodded.
Somebody else on this train?
Yes.
Whose is it?
I told you just now, I don't know. I woke up this morning about 5 o'clock with the feeling that the train had been standing still for a long time. I opened the door and looked out into the corridor, thinking we might be at a station. I saw someone in a scarlet kimono some way down the corridor.
And you don't know who it was? Was she fair or dark or grey-haired?
I can't say. She had on a shingle cap, and I only saw the back of her head.
And in build?
Tallish and slim, I should judge, but it's difficult to say. The kimono was embroidered with dragons.
Yes, yes, that is right, dragons.
He was silent a minute. He murmured to himself,
I cannot understand, I cannot understand. None of this makes sense.
Then, looking up, he said, I need not keep you further, mademoiselle.
Oh.
She seemed rather taken aback, but rose promptly. In the doorway, however, she hesitated a minute and then came back. The Swedish lady, Miss Olsen, is it, seems rather worried. She says you told her she was the last person to see this man alive. She thinks, I believe, that you suspect her on that account. Can't I tell her that she has made a mistake? Really, you know, she is the kind of creature who wouldn't hurt a fly. She smiled a little as she spoke.
What time was it that she went to fetch the aspirin from Mrs. Abbott?
Just after 10:30.
She was away how long?
About 5 minutes.
Did she leave the compartment again during the night?
No.
Poirot turned to the doctor. Could Ratchet have been killed as early as that?
The doctor shook his head.
Then I think you can reassure your friend, mademoiselle.
Thank you.
She smiled suddenly at him, a smile that invited sympathy.
She's like a sheep, you know. She gets anxious and bleats.
She turned and went out.
Chapter 12. The Evidence of the German Lady's Maid.
Monsieur Bouc was looking at his friend curiously.
I do not quite understand you, mon vieux. You were trying to do what?
I was searching for a flaw, my friend.
A flaw?
Yes, in the armour of a young lady's self-possession. I wished to shake your sang-froid.
Did I succeed?
I do not know, but I know this. She did not expect me to tackle the matter as I did.
You suspect her?
Said Monsieur Bouc slowly. But why, she seems a very charming young lady, the last person in the world to be mixed up in a crime of this kind.
I agree, said Constantine. She is cold. She has not emotions. She would not stab a man. She would sue him in the law courts.
Poirot sighed. You must both of you get rid of your obsession that this is an unpremeditated and sudden crime. As for the reason why I suspect Miss Debenham, there are two. One is because of something that I overheard, and that you do not as yet know.
He retailed to them the curious interchange of phrases he had overheard on the journey from Aleppo.
That is curious, certainly, said Monsieur Bouc when he had finished. It needs explaining.
If it means what you suspect it means, then they are both of them in it together, she and the stiff Englishman.
Poirot nodded.
And that is just what is not borne out by the facts, he said.
See you, if they were both in this together, what should we expect to find? That each of them would provide an alibi for the other, is not that so?
But no, that does not happen. Miss Debenham's alibi is provided by a Swedish woman whom she has never seen before, and Colonel Arbuthnot's alibi is vouched for by McQueen, the dead man's secretary.
No, that solution of the puzzle is too easy.
You said there was another reason for your suspicions of her, Monsieur Bouc reminded him.
Poirot smiled.
Ah, but that is only psychological. I ask myself, is it possible for Miss Debenham to have planned this crime? Behind this business, I am convinced there is a cool, intelligent, resourceful brain. Miss Debenham answers to that description.
Monsieur Book shook his head. I think you are wrong, my friend. I do not see that young English girl as a criminal.
Ah, well, said Poirot, picking up the last passport. To the final name on our list, Hildegard Schmidt, lady's maid.
Summoned by the attendant, Hildegard Schmidt came into the restaurant car and stood waiting respectfully. Poirot motioned her to sit down. She did so, folding her hands and waiting placidly till he questioned her. She seemed a placid creature altogether, eminently respectable, perhaps not over-intelligent. Poirot's methods with Hildegard Schmidt were a complete contrast to his handling of Mary Debenham. He was at his kindest and most genial, setting the woman at her ease. Then, having got her to write down her name and address, he slid gently into his questions. The interview took place in German.
"We want to know as much as possible about what happened last night," he said. "We know that you cannot give us much information bearing on the crime itself, but you may have seen or heard something that, while conveying nothing to you, may be valuable to us. You understand?"
She did not seem to. Her broad, kindly face remained set in its expression of placid stupidity as she answered, "I do not know anything, monsieur."
"Well, for instance, you know that your mistress sent for you last night?"
"That, yes."
"Do you remember the time?"
"I do not, monsieur. I was asleep, you see, when the attendant came and told me."
"Yes, yes. Was it usual for you to be sent for in this way?"
"It was not unusual, monsieur. The gracious lady often required attention at night. She did not sleep well."
"Eh bien, then you received the summons, and you got up. Did you put on a dressing gown?"
"No, monsieur, I put on a few clothes. I would not like to go into Her Excellency in my dressing gown."
"And yet it is a very nice dressing gown. Scarlet, is it not?"
She stared at him. "It is a dark blue flannel dressing gown, monsieur."
"Ah, continue."
"A little pleasantry on my part, that is all. So, you went along to Madame la Princesse, and what did you do when you got there?" "I gave her massage, monsieur, and then I read aloud. I do not read aloud very well, but Her Excellency says that is all the better, so it sends her better to sleep. When she became sleepy, monsieur, she told me to go. So I closed the book, and I returned to my own compartment."
"Do you know what time that was?"
"No, monsieur."
"Well, how long had you been with Madame la Princesse?"
"About half an hour, monsieur."
"Good, continue."
"First, I fetched Her Excellency an extra rug from my compartment. It was very cold, in spite of the heating. I arranged the rug over her, and she wished me good night. I poured her out some mineral water, then I turned out the light and left her."
"And then?"
"There is nothing more, monsieur. I returned to my carriage and went to sleep."
"And you met no one in the corridor?"
"No, monsieur."
"You did not, for instance, see a lady in a scarlet kimono with dragons on it?"
Her mild eyes bulged at him. "No, indeed, monsieur. There was nobody about except the attendant. Everyone was asleep."
"But you did see the conductor?"
"Yes, monsieur."
What was he doing?"
"He came out of one of the compartments, monsieur."
"What?" Monsieur Book leaned forward. "Which one?" Hildegard Schmidt looked frightened again, and Poirot cast a reproachful glance at his friend. "Naturally," he said, "the conductor often has to answer bells at night. Do you remember which compartment it was?"
"It was about the middle of the coach, monsieur, 2 or 3 doors from Madame la Princesse."
"Ah, tell us, if you please, exactly where this was and what happened."
"He nearly ran into me, monsieur. It was when I was returning from my compartment to that of the princess with the rug."
"And he came out of a compartment and almost collided with you? In which direction was he going?"
"Towards me, monsieur. He apologized and passed on down the corridor towards the dining car. A bell began ringing, but I do not think he answered it."
She paused and then said,
"I do not understand. How is it?"
Poirot spoke reassuringly. "It is just a question of times," he said. "All a matter of routine. This poor conductor, he seems to have had a busy night, first waking you and then answering bells."
"It was not the same conductor who woke me, monsieur. It was another one."
"Ah, another one? Had you seen him before?"
"No, monsieur."
Do you think you would recognize him if you saw him?
I think so, monsieur.
Poirot murmured something in Monsieur Bouc's ear. The latter got up and went to the door to give an order. Poirot was continuing his questions in an easy, friendly manner.
Have you ever been to America, Frau Schmidt?
Never, monsieur. It must be a fine country.
You have heard, perhaps, of who this man who was killed really was? That he was responsible for the death of a little child?
Yes, I have heard, monsieur. It was abominable, wicked. The good God should not allow such things. We are not so wicked as that in Germany.
Tears had come into the woman's eyes. Her strong, motherly soul was moved.
It was an abominable crime, said Poirot gravely.
He drew a scrap of cambric from his pocket and handed it to her.
Is this your handkerchief, Frau Schmidt?
There was a moment's silence as the woman examined it. She looked up after a minute. The colour had mounted a little in her face.
Ah, no, indeed, it is not mine, monsieur.
It has the initial H, you see, that is why I thought it was yours.
Ah, monsieur, it is a lady's handkerchief, that, a very expensive handkerchief. Embroidered by hand, it comes from Paris, I should say.
It is not yours, and you do not know whose it is?
No, monsieur.
Of the three listening, only Poirot caught the nuance of hesitation in the reply. Monsieur Bouc whispered in his ear. Poirot nodded and said to the woman, "The three sleeping car attendants are coming in. Will you be so kind as to tell me which is the one you met last night as you were going with the rug to the princess?"
The three men entered. Pierre Michel, the big blonde conductor of the Athens-Paris coach, and the stout, burly conductor of the Bucharest one. Hildegard Schmidt looked at them and immediately shook her head.
"No, monsieur," she said, "none of these is the man I saw last night."
"But these are the only conductors on the train. You must be mistaken."
"I am quite sure, monsieur. These are all tall, big men. The one I saw was small and dark. He had a little moustache. His voice, when he said pardon, was weak, like a woman's. Indeed, I remember him very well, monsieur."
Chapter 13. Summary of the passenger's evidence. "A small, dark man with a womanish voice," said Monsieur Bouc. The three conductors and Hildegard Schmidt had been dismissed.
"But I understand nothing, but nothing of all this. The enemy that this ratchet spoke of, he was then on the train after all? But where is he now? How can he have vanished into thin air? My head, it whirls.
Say something then, my friend, I implore you. Show me how the impossible can be possible."
"It is a good phrase, that," said Poirot.
"The impossible cannot have happened, therefore the impossible must be possible in spite of appearances.
Explain to me then, quickly, what actually happened on the train last night?"
"I am not a magician, mon cher. I am, like you, a
very puzzled man. This affair advances in a very strange manner."
"It does not advance at all. It stays where it was."
Poirot shook his head.
"No, that is not true. We are more advanced. We know certain things. We have heard the evidence of the passengers."
"And what has that told us? Nothing at all."
"I would not say that, my friend."
"I exaggerate, perhaps. The American Hardman and the German maid, yes, they have added something to our knowledge. That is to say, they have made the whole business more unintelligible than it was."
"No, no, no," said Poirot soothingly.
Monsieur Bouc turned upon him. "Speak, then, let us hear the wisdom of Hercule Poirot."
"Did I not tell you that I was, like you, a very puzzled man? But at least we can face our problem. We can arrange such facts as we have with order and method."
"Pray continue, monsieur," said Dr. Constantine. Poirot cleared his throat and straightened a piece of blotting paper.
"Let us review the case as it stands at this moment. First, there are certain indisputable facts. This man, Ratchet, or Cassetti, was stabbed in 12 places and died last night. That is fact one.
I grant it to you. I grant it, mon vieux, said Monsieur Bouc with a gesture of irony. Hercule Poirot was not at all put out. He continued calmly. I will pass over for the moment certain rather peculiar appearances which Dr. Constantine and I have already discussed together. I will come to them presently. The next fact of importance to my mind is the time of the crime.
That, again, is one of the few things we do know, said Monsieur Bouc. The crime was committed at 1:15 this morning. Everything goes to show that that was so.
Not everything. You exaggerate. There is certainly a fair amount of evidence to support that view.
I am glad you admit that, at least.
Poirot went on calmly, unperturbed by the interruption. We have before us three possibilities. One, that the crime was committed, as you say, at 1:15. This is supported by the evidence of the German woman, Hildegard Schmidt. It agrees with the evidence of Dr. Constantine. Possibility two, the crime was committed later, and the evidence of the watch was deliberately faked. Possibility three, the crime was committed earlier, and the evidence faked for the same reason as above. Now, if we accept possibility one as the most likely to have occurred, and the one supported by most evidence, we must also accept certain facts arising from it. To begin with, if the crime was committed at 1:15, the murderer cannot have left the train. And the question arises, where is he? And who is he? To begin with, let us examine the evidence carefully. We first hear of the existence of this man, the small, dark man with a womanish voice, from the man Hardman. He says that Ratchet told him of this person and employed him to watch out for the man. There is no evidence to support this. We have only Hardman's word for it. Let us next examine the question. Is Hardman the person he pretends to be? An operative of a New York detective agency? What to my mind is so interesting in this case is that we have none of the facilities afforded to the police. We cannot investigate the bona fides of any of these people. We have to rely solely on deduction. That, to me, makes the matter very much more interesting. There is no routine work. It is a matter of the intellect. I ask myself, can we accept Hardman's account of himself? I make my decision, and I answer, yes. I am of the opinion that we can accept Hardman's account of himself.
You rely on the intuition, what the Americans call the hunch, said Dr. Constantine.
Not at all. I regard the probabilities. Hardman is traveling with a false passport. That will at once make him an object of suspicion. The first thing that the police will do when they do arrive upon the scene is to detain Hardman and cable as to whether his account of himself is true. In the case of many of the passengers, to establish their bona fides will be difficult. In most cases, it will probably not be attempted, especially since there seems nothing in the way of suspicion attaching to them. But in Hardman's case, it is simple. Either he is the person he represents himself to be, or he is not. Therefore, I say that all will prove to be in order.
You acquit him of suspicion?
Not at all. You misunderstand me.
For all I know, any American detective might have his own private reasons for wishing to murder Ratchet.
No. What I am saying is that I think we can accept Hardman's own account of himself. This story, then, that he tells of Ratchet seeking him out and employing him is not unlikely and is most probably, though not, of course, certainly, true. If we are going to accept it as true, we must see if there is any confirmation of it. We find it in rather an unlikely place, in the evidence of Hildegard Schmidt. Her description of the man she saw in Wagon Lee uniform tallies exactly. Is there any further confirmation of these two stories?
There is.
There is the baton found in her compartment by Mrs. Hubbard. And there is also another corroborating statement which you may not have noticed.
What is that?
The fact that both Colonel Arbuthnot and Hector McQueen mentioned that the conductor passed their carriage. They attached no importance to the fact, but messieurs,
Pierre Michel has declared that he did not leave his seat except on certain specified occasions, none of which would take him down to the far end of the coach, past the compartment in which Arbuthnot and McQueen were sitting. Therefore, this story, the story of a small dark man with a womanish voice dressed in vagonly uniform, rests on the testimony, direct or indirect, of four witnesses.
One small point, said Dr. Constantine. If Hildegard Schmidt's story is true, how is it that the real conductor did not mention having seen her when he came to answer Mrs. Hubbard's bell?
That is explained, I think. When he arrived to answer Mrs. Hubbard, the maid was in with her mistress. When she finally returned to her own compartment, the conductor was in with Mrs. Hubbard. Monsieur Bouc had been waiting with difficulty until they had finished.
Yes, yes, my friend, he said impatiently to Poirot, but whilst I admire your caution, your method of advancing a step at a time, I submit that you have not yet touched the point at issue. We are all agreed that this person exists. The point is, where did he go?
Poirot shook his head reprovingly. You are in error. You are inclined to put the cart before the horse. Before I ask myself, where did this man vanish to, I ask myself, did such a man really exist? Because, you see, if the man were an invention, a fabrication, how much easier to make him disappear? So, I try to establish first that there really is such a flesh-and-blood person. And having arrived at the fact that there is, eh bien, where is he now?
There are only two answers to that, mon cher. Either he is still hidden on the train in a place of such extraordinary ingenuity that we cannot even think of it, or else he is, as one might say, two persons. That is, he is both himself, the man feared by Monsieur Ratchet, and a passenger on the train so well disguised that Monsieur Ratchet did not recognize him.
It is an idea, that, said Monsieur Bouc, his face lighting up. Then it clouded over again. But there is one objection.
Poirot took the words out of his mouth.
The height of the man, it is that, you would say. With the exception of Monsieur Ratchet's valet, all the passengers are big men, the Italian, Colonel Arbuthnot, Hector McQueen, Count Andreny.
Well, that leaves us the valet, not a very likely supposition.
But there is another possibility.
Remember the womanish voice?
That gives us a choice of alternatives.
The man may be disguised as a woman, or alternatively, he may actually be a woman. A tall woman dressed in man's clothes would look small.
But surely Ratchet would have known. Perhaps he did know. Perhaps already this woman had attempted his life wearing men's clothes, the better to accomplish her purpose. Ratchet may have guessed that she would use the same trick again, so he tells Hardman to look for a man, but he mentions, however, a womanish voice.
It is a possibility, said Monsieur Bouc, but
listen, my friend, I think that I should now tell you of certain inconsistencies noticed by Dr. Constantine. He retailed at length the conclusions that he and the doctor had arrived at together from the nature of the dead man's wounds.
Monsieur Bouc groaned and held his head again.
I know, said Poirot sympathetically, I know exactly how you feel. The head spins, does it not?
The whole thing is a fantasy, cried Monsieur Bouc.
Exactly. It is absurd, improbable. It cannot be.
So I myself have said. And yet, my friend, there it is. One cannot escape from the facts.
It is madness.
Is it not? It is so mad, my friend, that sometimes I am haunted by the sensation that really
it must be very simple. But that is only one of my little ideas.
Two murderers, groaned Monsieur Bouc, and on the Orient Express.
The thought almost made him weep.
And now, let us make the fantasy more fantastique, said Poirot cheerfully. Last night on the train there are two mysterious strangers. There is the wagon-lit attendant answering to the description given us by Monsieur Hardman and seen by Hildegard Schmidt, Colonel Arbuthnot, and Monsieur McQueen. There is also a woman in a red kimono, a tall, slim woman seen by Pierre Michel,
by Miss Debenham, by Monsieur McQueen, and by myself, and smelt, I may say, by Colonel Arbuthnot. Who was she? No one on the train admits to having a scarlet kimono. She, too, has vanished. Was she one and the same with the spurious wagon-lit attendant? Or was she some quite distinct personality? Where are they, these two? And incidentally, where is the wagon-lit uniform and the scarlet kimono? Ah, that is something definite. Monsieur Bouc sprang up eagerly. We must search all the passengers' luggage. Yes, that will be something. Poirot rose also. I will make a prophecy, he said. You know where they are? I have a little idea. Where, then? You will find the scarlet kimono in the baggage of one of the men, and you will find the uniform of the wagon-lit conductor in the baggage of Hildegard Schmidt. Hildegard Schmidt? You think not what you are thinking. I will put it like this. If Hildegard Schmidt is guilty, the uniform might be found in her baggage. But if she is innocent, it certainly will be. But how? Began Monsieur Bouc and stopped. What is this noise that approaches? He cried. It resembles a locomotive in motion. The noise drew nearer. It consisted of shrill cries and protests in a woman's voice. The door at the end of the dining car flew open. Mrs. Hubbard burst in. It's too horrible, she cried. It's just too horrible. In my sponge bag, a great knife, all over blood. And suddenly, toppling forward, she fainted heavily on Monsieur Bouc's shoulder. Chapter 14. The Evidence of the Weapon. With more vigour than chivalry, Monsieur Bouc deposited the fainting lady with her head on the table. Dr. Constantine yelled for one of the restaurant attendants, who came at a run.
"Keep her head so," said the doctor. "If she revives, give her a little cognac. You understand?"
Then he hurried off after the other two. His interest lay wholly in the crime. Swooning middle-aged ladies did not interest him at all. It is possible that Mrs. Hubbard revived rather quicker with these methods than she might otherwise have done. A few minutes later she was sitting up, sipping cognac from a glass proffered by the attendant, and talking once more.
"I just can't say how terrible it was. I don't suppose anybody on this train can understand my feelings. I have always been very, very sensitive ever since a child. The mere sight of blood, oh, why, even now I come over queer when I think about it."
The attendant proffered the glass again.
"Encore un peu, madame."
"You think I'd better? I'm a lifelong teetotaler. I just never touch spirits or wine at any time. All my family are abstainers. Still, perhaps this is only medical."
She sipped once more. In the meantime, Poirot and Monsieur Bouc, closely followed by Dr. Constantine, had hurried out of the restaurant car and along the corridor of the Stamboul coach towards Mrs. Hubbard's compartment. Every traveller on the train seemed to be congregated outside the door. The conductor, a harassed look on his face, was keeping them back.
"Mais il n'y a rien à voir," he said, and repeated the sentiment in several other languages.
"Let me pass, if you please," said Monsieur Bouc. Squeezing his rotundity past the obstructing passengers, he entered the compartment, Poirot close behind him.
"I am glad you have come, monsieur," said the conductor with a sigh of relief. "Everyone has been trying to enter the American lady. Such screams as she gave, ma foi. I thought she too had been murdered. I came at a run, and there she was screaming like a mad woman, and she cried out that she must fetch you, and she departed screeching at the top of her voice and telling everybody whose carriage she passed what had occurred." He added with a gesture of the hand, "It is in there, monsieur. I have not touched it."
Hanging on the handle of the door that gave access to the next compartment was a large-size checked rubber sponge bag. Below it, on the floor, just where it had fallen from Mrs. Hubbard's hand, was a straight-bladed dagger. A cheap affair, sham oriental with an embossed hilt and a tapering blade. The blade was stained with patches of what looked like rust. Poirot picked it up delicately.
"Yes," he murmured, "there is no mistake. Here is our missing weapon, all right, eh, doctor?"
The doctor examined it. You need not be so careful, said Poirot. There will be no fingerprints on it save those of Mrs. Abbott.
Constantine's examination did not take long.
It is the weapon, all right, he said. It would account for any of the wounds.
I implore you, my friend, do not say that.
The doctor looked astonished.
Already we are heavily overburdened by coincidence. Two people decide to stab Monsieur Ratchet last night. It is too much of a good thing that each of them should select an identical weapon.
As to that, the coincidence is not perhaps so great as it seems, said the doctor. Thousands of these sham Eastern daggers are made and shipped to the bazaars of Constantinople.
You console me a little, but only a little, said Poirot.
He looked thoughtfully at the door in front of him. Then, lifting off the sponge bag, he tried the handle. The door did not budge. About a foot above the handle was the door bolt. Poirot drew it back and tried again, but still the door remained fast.
We locked it from the other side, you remember, said the doctor.
That is true, said Poirot absently. He seemed to be thinking about something else. His brow was furrowed as though in perplexity.
It agrees, does it not, said Monsieur Bouc. The man passes through this carriage. As he shuts the communicating door behind him, he feels the sponge bag. A thought comes to him, and he quickly slips the blood-stained knife inside. Then, all unwitting that he has awakened Mrs. Hubbard, he slips out through the other door into the corridor.
As you say, murmured Poirot, that is how it must have happened.
But the puzzled look did not leave his face.
But what is it, demanded Monsieur Bouc, there is something, is there not, that does not satisfy you?
Poirot darted a quick look at him. The same point does not strike you?
No.
Evidently not. Well, it is a small matter. The conductor looked into the carriage.
The American lady is coming back.
Dr. Constantine looked rather guilty. He had, he felt, treated Mrs. Hubbard rather cavalierly, but she had no reproaches for him. Her energies were concentrated on another matter.
I'm just going to say one thing right out, she said breathlessly as she arrived in the doorway. I'm not going on any longer in this compartment. Why, I wouldn't sleep in it tonight if you paid me $1,000,000.
But, madame,
I know what you're going to say, and I'm telling you right now that I won't do any such thing. Why, I'd rather sit up all night in the corridor. She began to cry. Oh, if my daughter could only know, if she could see me now, why...
Poirot interrupted firmly. You misunderstand, madame. Your demand is most reasonable. Your baggage shall be changed at once to another compartment. Mrs. Hubbard lowered her handkerchief.
Is that so? Oh, I feel better right away, but surely it's all full up unless one of the gentlemen...
Monsieur Bouc spoke. Your baggage, madam, shall be moved out of this coach altogether. You shall have a compartment in the next coach, which was put on at Belgrade.
Why, that's splendid. I'm not an out-of-the-way nervous woman, but to sleep in that compartment next door to a dead man, she shivered, it would drive me plumb crazy.
Michel, called Monsieur Bouc, move this baggage into a vacant compartment in the Athens-Paris coach.
Yes, monsieur, the same one as this, the number 3?
No, said Poirot before his friend could reply. I think it would be better for madame to have a different number altogether. The number 12, for instance.
Bien, monsieur.
The conductor seized the luggage. Mrs. Hubbard turned gratefully to Poirot.
That's very kind and delicate of you. I appreciate it, I assure you.
Do not mention it, madame. We will come with you and see you comfortably installed.
Mrs. Hubbard was escorted by the 3 men to her new home. She looked round her happily. This is fine.
It suits you, madame. It is, you see, exactly like the compartment you have left.
That's so. Only it faces the other way. But that doesn't matter, for these trains go first one way and then the other. I said to my daughter, I want a carriage facing the engine. And she said, why, mama, that'll be no good to you, for if you go to sleep one way, when you wake up, the train's going the other. And it was quite true what she said. Why, last evening we went into Belgrade one way and out the other.
At any rate, madame, you are quite happy and contented now?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. Here we are stuck in a snowdrift and nobody doing anything about it, and my boat sailing the day after tomorrow.
Madame, said Monsieur Bouc, we are all in the same case, every one of us.
Well, that's true, admitted Mrs. Hubbard. But nobody else has had a murderer walking right through their compartment in the middle of the night.
What still puzzles me, madame, said Poirot, is how the man got into your compartment if the communicating door was bolted, as you say. You are sure that it was bolted?
Why, the Swedish lady tried it before my eyes.
Let us just reconstruct that little scene. You are lying in your bunk, so, and you could not see for yourself, you say.
No, because of the sponge bag. Oh, my, I shall have to get a new sponge bag. It makes me feel sick in my stomach to look at this one.
Poirot picked up the sponge bag and hung it on the handle of the communicating door into the next carriage.
Précisément, I see, he said, the bolt is just underneath the handle. The sponge bag masks it. You could not see from where you were lying whether the bolt were turned or not.
Why, that's just what I've been telling you.
And the Swedish lady, Miss Olsen, stood so, between you and the door. She tried it and told you it was bolted.
That's so.
All the same, madame, she may have made an error. You see what I mean?
Poirot seemed anxious to explain. The bolt is just a projection of metal, so.
Turn to the right, the door is locked. Left, straight, it is not.
Possibly she merely tried the door, and as it was locked on the other side, she may have assumed that it was locked on your side.
Well, I guess that would be rather stupid of her.
Madame, the most kind, the most amiable are not always the cleverest.
That's so, of course.
By the way, madame, did you travel out to Smyrna this way?
No, I sailed right to Istanbul, and a friend of my daughter's, Mr. Johnson, a perfectly lovely man, I'd like to have you know him, met me and showed me all round Istanbul, which I found a very disappointing city, all tumbling down. And as for those mosques and putting on those great shuffling things over your shoes, where was I?
You were saying that Mr. Johnson met you?
That's so, and he saw me on board a French messagerry boat for Smyrna, and my daughter's husband was waiting right on the quay. What he'll say when he hears about all this. My daughter said this would be just the safest, easiest way imaginable. You just sit in your carriage, she said, and you get right to Paris, and there the American Express will meet you. And oh, dear, what am I to do about canceling my steamship passage? I ought to let them know. I can't possibly make it now. This is just too terrible.
Mrs. Hubbard showed signs of tears once more. Poirot, who had been fidgeting slightly, seized his opportunity.
You have had a shock, madame. The restaurant attendant shall be instructed to bring you along some tea and some biscuits.
Well, I don't know that I'm so set on tea, said Mrs. Hubbard tearfully. That's more an English habit.
Coffee, then, madame. You need some stimulant.
Well, that cognac's made my head feel mighty funny. I think I would like some coffee.
Excellent. You must revive your forces.
My, what a funny expression.
But first, madame, a little matter of routine. You permit that I make a search of your baggage?
Whatever for.
We are about to commence a search of all the passengers' luggage. I do not want to remind you of an unpleasant experience, but your sponge bag, remember?
Mercy, perhaps you'd better. I just couldn't bear to get any more surprises of that kind.
The examination was quickly over. Mrs. Hubbard was traveling with the minimum of luggage, a hat box, a cheap suitcase, and a well-burdened travelling bag. The contents of all three were simple and straightforward, and the examination would not have taken more than a couple of minutes had not Mrs. Hubbard delayed matters by insisting on due attention being paid to photographs of my daughter and two rather ugly children, my daughter's children. Aren't they cunning?